Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cause podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Macko and Cause podcast. This is take two. Take one, thankfully, only 30 seconds long when I realized I had not plugged the microphones in. Hey, Bob.
Hello, Matthew. We got to get right into it today.
Yeah, there's tons and tons of sports. Aaron Judge, Rasmus Sandin, the Buffalo Bills nearly all died of heat stroke. So much to talk about.
There is a lot. Do you want to do the Leafs or Aaron Judge first?
Let's get Sandin out of the way.
Okay.
Thank God it got signed because it was the most boring contract stalemate of all time.
As we were coming into the building, yeah. He signed for 2 years, 1.4 AAV.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, pretty much what he'd been offered for most of the summer.
Correct.
So this was it wasn't a big waste of time in the sense that no games were lost and he'll have most of a training camp. I wonder what it is. I'm always fascinated by what is it that makes one side or the other decide, okay, today's the day I'm going to get off my soapbox and just make it happen.
But it's the same offer they did in June. And it's September 29th.
Well, I would suggest that the impasse was on the Sandin camp side. Yeah. Since the Leafs didn't seem to change or particularly come down or go up or any of that.
Well, Kyle Dubas is a hard ass when it comes to negotiating.
Maybe he got better. That would be that would be great to find out that that's one of the skills he's picking up as he goes along.
Hey, we all can adapt as people. It's what makes it great to be a human.
I don't know what the future is for Jake Muzzin with this team. Nobody really does.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's quote unquote shrouded in secrecy. It's not like Robidoux Island. Mm-hmm. I would say how you use him at this point is very open to debate. How important is the regular season to you? He was brought back. It sounds like he was never even being considered to be traded.
No.
So they clearly believe he can help them win that fabled playoff round. So I don't know. Like his back's sore. He's had back problems before. He's old. He's banged up. His knee brace honestly looks like a Terminator.
His knee brace has a knee brace.
An auxiliary knee brace, yeah, just for help?
His knee brace is like Tom Brady's when he was sliding in the Packers game. At least Muzzin looked good in the playoffs. And if you're Sandin, hopefully in the end this is what it came down to. Do you really want to win the battle for an extra $200,000? Because there's a war out there, and the prize is being maybe on the top line with Morgan Riley. And that prize, if you win that battle, then you'll win the war because you'll get that big fat contract.
There are times when we look at labor negotiations in the world at large, mm-hmm. and we think this is a battle one side has to try to win because there's something not just generational, but almost philosophical about it.
Yeah.
You see this with labor negotiations between players and the league sometimes, and they'll just bring the whole thing down because it completely changes or could change the economics of a multi-billion dollar industry. Then when you look at Rasmus Sandin and say, wait, he won't play for 1.4, yeah. but he would play for 1.6.
What are we doing?
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, that's it. It's stupid. It's like, get into training camp. Liljegren is out. Muzzin's banged up. All these other guys are now hurt. Everyone's hurt for goddamn Maple Leafs. So yes, get in there. Get the opportunity. Maybe figure out to play on your offside. Play on the right side. Play with Morgan Riley. And wealth will come. Like, yes, Bob, to the point, here's one the NHL maybe should have fought harder for, not the salary cap.
Two observations. One is, once again, the real winner here is you, because mm-hmm. you don't have to talk about this on every show for the next 4 months.
Yeah.
And two, okay, for years now, going back to Dion Phaneuf and who could play with Phaneuf, this idea of this mythical right shot D is so valuable. Okay, I get that. It's like left-handed relievers. It's mm-hmm. just, it's a thing. It's rare. You need it. I get that. But why don't they teach the left-handed defensemen when they're little how to play both sides?
Yes.
If you were a field, like in baseball, how many times have you heard he started out as an outfielder, then he was a catcher, they realized he was a pitcher. But there's something about hockey, it's like, we started him at defense when he was 5, and he literally can't tie his skates if we asked him to play any other position in any other way.
It's so true. And Sandin's young. You're right. Just learn to play on that other side.
But it's like amazing to me, you know, you see, and look, I'm not saying people are stupid, but I honestly don't get it. Like this idea of the magical jump from forward to center. You could have the world's most talented forward.
Yeah.
Patrick Kane times Rocket Richard.
Ooh.
But if you try to move him over to center,
yeah,
he'd be like you and me on the skates.
Yeah, it's true. There is something about the rigidity of the NHL, I think, is what you're getting at here. And yeah, you're right. And just figure it out. You're a young guy.
You know, honestly, it's a multi-billion dollar industry.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I keep a little eye on the news. And it seems like these multi-billion dollar industries, they figure out little problems like this.
They do.
But there's just something. It's whether it's goaltending or why can't lefty play on the right side. I don't know what it is about hockey.
Yeah.
But if you don't start early, it can never happen.
Never happen. You got, then it's it. The cement has hardened and and we're moving on. By the way, real quick about battles to fight.
Yeah.
Jágr's been retired for quite a while, right?
Yeah. Or I think he still plays maybe in the Czech Republic. He's like an owner player?
Probably. One of Jágr's last deals in the NHL is only about $1 million less than Nathan MacKinnon's deal, who is now the highest paid player in the NHL. That whole salary cap thing is a real motherfucker for the players.
You know, that's an amazing stat. That's a pretty amazing stat.
Yeah.
It was weird. There was that crazy time, like the Chris Gratton deal, I think, was like the first one where everyone went, what?
Yeah.
In basketball, it was Jim McElvain.
Yes.
If you remember, Jim McElvain, he was a center with the Seattle Supersonics, all of a sudden got $11 million a year. He was making 5 times 11 for $55 million.
Yep.
And I remember Georgie, who was covering basketball at the time for The Fan, he told me he was in the dressing room. He was covering the visitor's dressing room. Pat Riley, someone said to him, McElvain got that money, right? And apparently Riley just looked at the ground, and you know what he said? Jim fucking McElvain.
And then Sean Kemp said the same thing, but louder, and up to the heavens, and to management, and interns, and the HR department with the Seattle Supersonics. And then soon he went to Cleveland and got fat.
Oh, that's actually a good question. This would be a good one to throw out there. What's the contract in sports that you looked at and said, okay, now that's just nuts?
I remember like an Olden Polonese deal or something. I'd have to go back and look. Yeah, I mean, there's tons of them out there. Usually it's baseball players getting some of these like 13-year deals.
Yeah, I feel like when we were kids, the Robin Yount Kirby Puckett moved to $3 million.
Yeah,
was just astonishing.
Yeah,
you could not wrap. And because we talked so little about how much money anybody makes back then, the idea that a player could make $3 million, it was just, I don't know, it was almost like watching a unicorn gallop or something.
Yeah, simpler time, but. Sandin, done, deal. Moving on from that. Bob, there's a lot of things to get into with, unless you have anything else. I was barreling ahead, but if you had any other hot Rasmus Sandin talk.
No.
All right.
I think the real story here is not necessarily what's the health of John Tavares in the short term.
Mm-hmm. But, yes.
But John Tavares over the course of 82 games and into the playoffs.
Ding, ding, ding.
That to me seems like the real question around this team.
I'm not worried about October. I'm worried about next October, you know, and like, and maybe everything will be fine. But just when you see 32 years old, oblique injury for the second time, but he was coming into camp. He was in incredible shape. So you're in incredible shape, and now you're out for minimum 3 weeks. So probably longer.
I don't think the team can really sustain a playoff run unless he's excellent. We always yell and scream about, is he worth $11 million?
Yeah.
And maybe he'll never be worth $11 million. Even at a point of game, he's not worth $11 million. But what he can't be is he can't be a 55-point player.
No.
Like, the Leafs are just not built for him. And whether it's through lack of performance or missing games, he just can't contribute under 70 points and have the Leafs be a really, really good team.
Yes, correct.
So I think that's the one to keep an eye on, really.
Oh, yeah. I always said the number one issue with the Maple Leafs is goalies. So far, there's been an absence of negative. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing in the preseason, absence of negative. But the other then is the second line.
I want to move to baseball because it feels like, how do you not on it the day after
Aaron Judge
hits 61 and ties Roger Maris, and now he's on the cusp with 7 games left. He has a chance to make history. And you and I have a romantic connection to baseball, both of us. We both grew up in homes, particularly yours, where it wasn't just the sport, but it was the majesty of the tradition that was part of the appeal. So how do you, what's your take on this today?
My take is such a boring one. If you want to be like Roger Maris Jr. and say that this is the true clean record, okay, fine. you know, if you want to say that what McGuire or Bonds did, you know, tainted with steroids, I get it. I myself look at this as the home run champ of all time is Barry Bonds, because we don't know how many pitchers were on steroids. I've never seen a player, even more than Tony Gwynn, I've never seen a player more talented with a baseball bat in their hands than Barry Bonds. So I still go with Bonds as number one. I think with Aaron Judge, the most remarkable thing here is he could hit for the Triple Crown. He's doing this in the hardest division in baseball. The gap between him and the number two guy in home runs is like 19 or 18. It's incredible.
I want to talk about what it, quote unquote, means on All Narrative Thursday.
Yeah.
But before we do that, I think what's really amazing about this to me is that when Maris does it in an era where pitchers throw nine innings regularly.
Yes.
Now things are so specialized. You know, you get two shots at your starter, maybe three if he's pitching a good game.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden out come the cavalcade of specialists.
All throwing 100 miles an hour.
It's a bit like Ovi's goal scoring, where you just can't compare it to other generations. Because, like, the goalies had a beer in their hand in the 1950s, and they were playing with pads that were essentially just like cellophane bubble wrap around their shins. It's just a totally different animal. So when Austin Matthews goes out and scores 60... you know, what does that translate to in the 80s? Who can say? Just the idea that you hit 61 in an era where it's so fucking hard to do anything well at the plate anymore.
Yeah, no one else is going to hit 50. And he's at 61. And again, in the hardest division, a division where a lot of teams spend a lot of money, or in the case of Tampa, they at least develop a lot of really talented players. And you're right, you always have to be careful with the eras. I know we're not going to talk about Brett Favre winning Man of the Year anytime soon, but whenever somebody said, well, look at all the interceptions he threw, it's like, well, it was a different era. Same thing. Troy Aikman only threw more than 20 touchdown passes once. It's like, you got to put everything in context. It's the same thing with Aaron Judge. To get this many home runs against this level of pitching is incredible.
The way that pitchers scout hitters now is astonishing. Now, that's true on both sides.
Yeah, the hitters can do it as well.
But just it's just not talent on talent anymore. There's so much coaching that goes on. It's really your point about the gap between him and everybody else.
Yeah, Kyle Schwarber, I think, is second.
Yeah, and it's irrelevant.
Yeah.
Really.
And I think Schwarber has like 38 home runs.
I feel like today's a bit of a bittersweet day for baseball. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly because of what you just said, which was, I think Barry Bonds is the real home run champ because the steroids is with the pitchers.
You know what this moment is, Bob? I'm already patting myself. I'm pre-patting myself on the back for this analogy.
Is this the thought of the day for tomorrow?
Oh, my God. Well, let's see. Yeah, maybe. Oh, God, this would be a good opening thought. In Ghostbusters, when they release all the ghosts back out into New York City causing shit.
Mm-hmm.
This is that moment in baseball when when Judge hit home run 61, all the ghosts came out. Sosa, Bonds, McGuire, steroids, clean, dirty. Hey, why is Roger Clemens catching strays? All the ghosts are coming back out again at this moment.
I love that. So it's almost like Field of Dreams, but in a bad way.
Yeah.
It's Field of Bad Dreams.
It's Field of Bad Dreams. And yes, this man has no dick. Because dickless over here.
I feel like you didn't give my joke proper weight because you had one loaded.
I did. You know what? You're right.
Field of Bad Dreams was awfully good, Matt.
You know what, Bob? You are right. I did not do active listening. I was racing ahead to my next joke. You were 100% right on that
and
one.
And having done hundreds of shows with you, I've never seen that before. It's not like you not to listen to the other person and wait to speak again.
Only when I've got at least a B-minus level joke. Yeah, so hold on. Let's go back to yours for a second.
We used to do interviews, and I would be like, okay, so did you kill the guy? And he'd be like, well, yeah. And then we'd have
Captain Caveman.
Right? And then we always had two questions, and then you would hand it off to the other guy. That was the protocol. So it'd be like, he just admitted to kill him, and you'd be like, what's your favorite fruit roll-up?
Ooh, I never really liked fruit roll-up. I felt like it was a compromise. If you got fruit roll-ups...
My mom was listening to your show.
Yeah.
And she's like, I like them. It's a bit silly.
Yeah. That kind of sums
up. Then there was some woman who comes on the show named Ariel something or other.
Ariel Epstein, yeah.
Yeah, she said she was really good.
Yeah, Ariel was. Hardworking, like crazy amount of knowledge in her.
Yeah.
So hold on. Field of Bad Dreams. Field of Bad Dreams. Is it just... no one can throw, and every time you catch, the ball falls out of your glove. Like now I want to explore what is Field of Bad Dreams. You know, is it, are you playing catch with Hitler? You know, what's going on in the Field of Bad Dreams?
What you said about Aaron Judge, when you stop and think about this. So let's just stop for a moment.
Yeah.
He looks like Paul Bunyan.
Yeah.
He plays for the Yankees. Mm-hmm. He is
the nicest guy.
The nicest guy.
Yeah.
He looks like he belongs in a milk commercial.
Yes.
He's respectful to his teammates.
He gave a shout out to Garrett Cole, who's got sourpuss face on for the entire game.
Everything about this guy should be folk legend. Mm-hmm. But we just can't go there anymore. And it got me to thinking, who in baseball is loved? And I don't mean respected by fans.
No, I know.
I don't think admired for their talent. Who in baseball is loved? Because most sports at any given time have someone who transcends the sport,
yep,
and they are loved.
I don't think you can have it in baseball because of the regional nature of the game.
Well, hockey's got a regional nature to it.
Yeah. But I don't know if anyone in the States has a hockey player that is loved.
Yeah, that's true.
I think loved only comes in football and basketball from a North American standpoint, if you take both Canada and the United States. In baseball, the closest is Aaron Judge. But again, it's the regional nature of the sport.
Football is America's sport.
Yeah.
And it has been for decades. Mm-hmm. Baseball was a radio sport. Football is a TV sport. It feels like basketball will be the sport of Instagram and memes.
Yep. Yes.
So it's not a surprise that doing this now is not the same as being Roger Maris. I mean, we talked about eras. How athletes are perceived in these sports is just different now. But what really jumps out at me is baseball was that sport. It was almost the antidote. When we were coming up, in the 80s, basketball was, how many conversations did we have on off the record about how you can't call them hoodlums?
Yes.
You can't call them thugs.
Yep.
Right? Like, mm-hmm, there was this latent racism in every basketball player, you know, who wasn't John Stockton, was kind of held out there as an enemy to society.
Right. Yeah.
You know, football, I think, probably always had its lunatic fringe aspect to it. Mm-hmm. But baseball was supposed to be the antidote to all that. Baseball was the tall glass of milk.
Yes.
And now I don't feel like it has that either. It's neither wholesome nor exciting.
Well, I mean, then you go down the road of just how the game would be better. I've said this over and over. If the game was filled with Greg Maddux, Tony Gwynn, and Ricky Henderson. Mm-hmm. If baseball was filled with a whole lot of those guys, that would be fantastic. It's just there isn't that star. There isn't. And if it's not Aaron... Put it this way. If it can't be Aaron Judge, then it can't be anyone. I think is what it kind of comes down to.
We've talked for years about Mike Trout being one of the greatest players in history.
Yep.
Kind of our Willie Mays,
yeah,
would be the best example, maybe. Mm-hmm. And there's been an inability for that person to ignite a kind of a popular fascination. But if you can't do it with Aaron Judge, to your point, like, yeah, literally, like Shohei Ohtani should be the new Ichiro, sure, should be the new Fernando Valenzuela.
Yeah.
And I think within a certain pocket, that's true, but that pocket gets smaller and smaller. If I was baseball, if I'm Rob Manfred, I look at this today and say, fuck, we can't start any fires.
No.
Like, we got all the dry kindling, but we can't start any fires.
Well, with Ohtani, first, you got to get him out of Anaheim. You got to put him East Coast. Second, because there's a language barrier, and this would be true in any country. If you put an English-speaking person in a country where English is not the first language and they couldn't, like, if you know, then that's going to be a barrier.
But that's bullshit, Ichiro is a sensation.
Yeah,
and Fernando Valenzuela, who didn't speak English, was a sensation.
He was because L.A., 80s, baseball was a bigger sport. Today, and I'm not saying that's the main barrier for Ohtani. That's one of the smaller ones. The main one is not winning and you're in Anaheim. I'm just including all the little parts to the pie chart.
It occurs to me that has Anaheim become the Edmonton Oilers of baseball, in that stars go there to be never heard from again? You go there and it's the worst thing that could happen for your league.
Yeah, it's true.
A harder time breaking through? Connor McDavid out of Edmonton?
Yep.
Or Mike Trout out of Anaheim? Or Ohtani at this point?
I think it's Trout because it hasn't happened.
Right.
Like, he's had years and years and years to do it. It hasn't happened.
I remember the Trout versus Cabrera MVP race, and yep. we were covering it, and it really was, in a lot of ways, it was the moment that analytics really rose to the fore, because the old school people said Cabrera's the guy, and then mm-hmm. the people who looked at the stats said Trout is clearly dominant. And
yep.
it was really, you know, chocolate versus peanut butter. And they actually never got together in this case.
And that is a shame.
It really is.
That is a shame.
It's a damn fine cup.
There's a, by the way, Amy bought like this duty-free giant thing of like peanut butter cups. I don't know how that bag is still full. It's in the fridge. It is yet to be opened.
Do you know what the key is? Mm. The key is it has to be over a certain size for you not to feel good about snacking on it.
Mm.
The yes. Halloween little cups.
Oh, yeah.
Do you
yeah.
remember those little icy cups?
Yeah. Yeah. Tiny little ones.
Yeah. You could have nine of those at one sitting, which is the equivalent of four chocolate bars.
Yeah. But it's so true.
But you didn't have four chocolate bars.
I didn't.
You had nine little nibbles.
I just little bite. Yes. It's the little bite fallacy.
The little chips are the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can have five bags of little chips,
yes.
which is more or less a big bag of chips.
Yeah.
But so you don't get this with pizza, right? Like pizza, you know how much it is. It fills you up. Other than your brother Josh at your Super Bowl party, no one can eat past a certain point of it.
Okay. And you're 100% right. My thing that I do to hide the shame, if there's been too much consumption of either pizza or chips or wine or whatever, I clean it up and I get rid of it. Like I put it, not only put it in the garbage, I put it down the garbage disposal. Or empty bottles of wine are put in a box in the closet. All glasses are cleaned. And I feel, I'm going full Lady Macbeth here.
You're Winston Wolfe.
I'm Winston Wolfe meets Lady Macbeth. I'm cleaning away my shame.
Out damned chocolate stain.
Yes, that is exactly what I'm doing.
Well, we can't really have a show without some kind of reference to something, right? Yes. So it's not going to be Jaws today. It's going to be Macbeth.
There's still time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There's still time.
You know, since it's all Narrative Thursday, the Aaron Judge thing made me think about Roger Federer and how valuable narrative is in sport. Now, I'm going to pontificate for just a second.
Go.
You know that I feel sports has gone down the wrong path with all this gambling talk. I'm not saying that there isn't fun in it, and I'm not saying it's not fun to gamble or be in fantasy sports. That's great.
But it's almost like an overcompensation. It's just got too saturated.
And I think like with, you know, I was thinking about, just like we've talked about Sports Illustrated in the past and how much it meant to have somebody really smart write a great story. I mean, Stephen Brunt was kind of our guy for a long time.
Yep, absolutely.
Bruce Arthur picked up the mantle for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. There aren't a lot of other people who are actually encouraged to write, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of just like, what's your hot take? You got a hot take on this?
Yep.
And I think because of that, there's a whole generation of people who grew up and thought, well, this is fucking stupid. Like, this is a hot take. You're just trying to get me to react to this. Because, you know, they're not given the space. They're not given the training. In a lot of cases, they're not given just the support.
Yes.
To write an interesting narrative. The narratives got stupid and people ran away from them. But Roger Federer, him sitting next to Rafa Nadal on his last match and then the celebration afterwards, and both of them crying, was so much more than sport. It really was everything. And I think it's great to win money. Who doesn't want to do that? But we don't love sports because it's an opportunity to gamble. We love sports because it teaches us something about life.
Yes.
People will roll their eyes at that. Fuck you. Sport is there to show us what we are like inside. It is one of the few remaining, you know, canvases on which we can see what people are really like when pushed to their limits, good and bad. And why Federer matters is because he was pushed to those limits and always reacted the way we hoped we would.
Yes.
He didn't even start that way. As a kid, he was a racket thrower. He was a sucky baby. He was, you know, he had to learn to be that person, which also for guys is nice to see. You know, I say this as a guy who was like in my 20s, you know, I could have done a hell of a lot better, but each decade I got better and better at stuff, I think. You know, so there was the promise of progress with Federer, but more importantly, there was elegance, there was grace, there was compassion in winning and losing. And if all of these things cease to matter, we're effed. And when we repopulate the sports world with testosterone hits and dopamine slashes, okay, like, yeah, it works, but then you're a hollowed out husk by the end of it. And this is what made me think why I was kind of sad with Aaron Judge, because we should all love this.
Yes.
But we don't, because they fucked it all up with their steroids bullshit. Because it was all like, well, if I can cheat and get away with it, I'm going to. Well, you know what? You don't think you're paying the piper, but you do. Because it's almost like, and I'm going to make a really grandiose point here, but how many institutions do we look at and go, you know what? I'd love to be excited about this, but I don't believe in you anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Whether it's government, whether it's the press, our level of trust, or our level of enthusiasm towards those institutions have been so greatly reduced.
And narrative is an important point of sustaining us through things that are troublesome, mm-hmm. because everything is troublesome. But if you believe that something can get better, you know, we have a tendency now to say, well, then you're a sucker and you're just lining up to get duped. Whereas in years past, it was you're lining up to put on your work boots because this needs to get better. And that's what we got from Federer. We didn't get it in the same way from Judge. And I get it from almost nothing in sports these days. And it makes me sad, like when I laugh that it's Narrative Thursday.
Yeah.
When you and I were doing sports radio, we were kind of pushing back against that stuff because they weren't driving narrative. They were simply doing their version of dopamine hits. Get me, you know, pay attention to me. I said something stupid.
Yeah.
And I'm doubling down on it. So, yeah, I kind of feel like in a weird sort of way, it's a bittersweet sports day because history was made and history doesn't matter as much as it used to.
Federer represented the best in humanity. And that's what we love about sports, when they represent the best in a person, because then it gives us something to strive for. And also it's a reminder of the goodness of people versus, you know, the hot take, Nadal and Federer choked. What are you talking about? They were doubles partners and they lose?
Like
you,
Serena. Yeah. Serena the choker.
You're a choker. You know, you're minus 263. I had $50 on you. But they represent, like people like Federer represent the best. Same thing with someone like Serena. And you're right. Aaron Judge, it should have strictly been this incredible achievement by an incredible human being having a crazy season on a winning team. But the ghosts got released. And Roger Maris Jr. talked about the record, which record is clean and which record's not. And today there's going to be the classic debates all over about steroid versus not. It's going to come up and it's going to muddy the waters of what should be this nice, clean, like, you know, the first thing in the morning when the water is like ice and there's a little bit of mist coming off of it. That's what it should be today, but it's going to be choppy waters.
The idea of history and narrative and institutions is the one thing that could bring Jeff Pollock and I together, mm-hmm. ideologically.
Yes.
We have completely different ways of interpreting it. Mm-hmm. If anyone's listened to the pod, you know Jeff's our sponsor and our lawyer.
JeffPollock.com. That's Jeff with a G. JeffPollock.com. If you need a lawyer, I cannot recommend anyone high enough. Jeff with a G. JeffPollock.com. Sponsor the pod.
He's a hardcore monarchist.
Yep.
And so when the queen passed away, that was tough for him. Like, yes. He was actually emotional. Mm-hmm. So I sent him a note,
yeah,
just saying, I know this really matters to you. And we went back and forth, and, you know, I'm not a monarchist.
What?
I know that may shock you, but...
Oh, my God.
I was okay,
yeah,
with it.
Like, you survived?
I did. I, you know... Okay. But I'm also respectful to the people, or tried to be. Yeah. I'm not sure I always was. Some people lashed out at me on Twitter for not being respectful of. But you know what? Honestly, that's okay. It meant a lot to them, and maybe...
Yeah.
You know, I did try to... I tried to really pull back. Mm-hmm. You know, there were no Sex Pistols references, none of that stuff.
I just retweeted Reggie Jackson saying, see, I didn't kill her. Like, and, like, but he did it in a very respectful way and then said, rest in peace and all that. But that's all I think I did. I think I retweeted a Reggie Jackson tweet. That was my coverage of the passing.
But it's just, I would hate to get to the point where history gets rewritten, mm-hmm. every generation. You know, one of the great things about sports is the greatest of all time conversation.
Yeah.
And it's getting harder and harder to have that conversation because nobody knows anything about the past.
Yes.
I see this in hockey. I feel like we've had this as Leafs fans because of the incredible losing that's happened. We've kind of just, I don't know, like we don't even think, like in Montreal, they care about the history of the team.
Yes.
In Toronto, which is just as, well, not quite as storied, but almost as storied a franchise. You know, how many fans do you know who can talk about Dave Keon?
Very few.
Outside of Dave Bedini.
Yeah.
Who can talk about Dave Keon?
Yeah. Well, listen, the Leafs have done that, though. Like, I can't fully blame the fans. The Leafs' ineptness and Ballard and you know, just so many bad GMs, they've taken away the history from the 60s, because history needs to be connecting. You know, there needs to be at least some threads. And there really aren't any. At least with Montreal winning in the 60s and 70s, then 80s with Waugh, then Waugh in 93, and then some crazy runs and Carey Price. At least there's some connective thread. For the Maple Leafs, it's been cut.
Well, it's about like Notre Dame, too, the Fighting Irish. They haven't really been a great team in two decades.
Oh, yeah. They haven't, not since like Rick Meyer, early 90s kind of.
Right.
Kind of
I mean, those the shootout with Miami and all this historic stuff that happened in the 80s and Lou Holtz. And, you know, that was a time. Mm-hmm. And they are still kind of dining out on that. I mean, they've been a very good team since then.
But they've never been a great team.
They've never been a great team.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because the narrative sustains you.
The narrative sustains, and narrative is important, and it's a wonderful thing in sports. You know, there's a reason why there are sports historians, because we love these stories.
I'll go further than this.
Yeah,
it's the thing in sports. Mm-hmm. We've gotten very good in the way that we all analyze productivity about everything at determining what works and what doesn't in the course of a game. In fact, a lot of sports analysis has become very micro.
Yes.
You know, if you do this with these repercussions and this and that, and it becomes a little bit like a lab report, like you're titrating chemicals and it's, you know.
What is the pass win rate of these offensive linemen?
You know, and it's almost like to talk about anything beyond that is almost like, oh, well, that's not for us. That's for the gods.
You know,
we're only here to analyze, you know, stats. Where I really saw this recently was OG's presser the other day. And someone asked him, how do you feel about the trade rumors? And he's like, I didn't take it very seriously. I was kind of surprised to see it. And half of Twitter went crazy saying, see all those idiots who made a big deal out of this? It was all for nothing. And OG loves it here. And he's so excited to play with Scotty. And everything is exactly as it should be. And I thought, you know, you guys are great at stats, but you suck at narratives.
Yeah.
Like a player sits there and says, I didn't really want to get traded before he's traded. And you're like, well, we should probably take him at his word. My point was, the new generation sucks at narrative. Outstanding at analysis, but they suck at storytelling and really understanding anything that goes on beyond the numbers.
Well, I think some of it is it's a pushback against maybe too much cliches being used. So then my favorite analogy is always by Carolla saying, grunge came because everyone was into hair bands. And then it's like, we need something the exact opposite of that. And I think we could see some of this where maybe too much cliches or momentum or all this stuff. And what narrative went too far and maybe a lazy crutch by mainstream media. And then the younger people said, fuck that. We're now going to crunch the numbers and we're going to go in a completely different way. And I always feel bad for that. Like I feel bad for people where they deny momentum or narrative. So I'm like, that's where a lot of the fun comes from. That's where the narrative comes from. Like, okay, I'll give you an example of where you can marry the two. Buffalo Bills quarterback Josh Allen.
Okay.
Josh Allen was horrible in terms of completion percentage in college. And his first couple of years in the NFL, he was bad, wild. We didn't know if he was going to make it. There was that playoff loss to Houston where he's throwing the ball all over the place. And now he's one of the most accurate quarterbacks. So on the analytical side, you can look at it and analyze it and the impact that Stephon Diggs has meant and how many throws he has to make to a receiver in a tight window versus those in an open window. Or it's a story of a bunch of individuals who just worked really hard and wanted to get better. Whether it was Brian Daboll, crazy Ken Dorsey, Sean McDermott, or Josh Allen, who's like, I'm going to work at this. And we love the narrative of just how hard work can make you better. And yes, sometimes we will pervert and weaponize that and use that in politics. But I love the Josh Allen story because here's a guy who just worked his ass off to become better at his craft.
It's a really great way of putting it. And what I hope doesn't happen in sports is that we don't lose the fact that what's interesting about Josh Allen is not the fact that he can now fire it inside of a pane of glass on a window. It's that he worked to get there.
Yeah.
And that's, again, just to loop it back to the very beginning before we move on, that's the point about Aaron Judge, is I don't feel like we're allowing ourselves to really enjoy this as much as we could because there are so many components to it where we correctly identify we would be stupid to stick our necks out here because they have proven to us you shouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, people wanted to believe. They were made to feel stupid about it. And now they don't want to look like suckers again. And to make this about politics, how much of the world right now can be summed up by, we wanted to believe in you, you made us look stupid, now we're not doing that again.
Yeah, all over the place. Littered. Right? Littered all over the place. By the way, I'll say this. I miss 1998. I loved it. Maguire, Sosa, cut-ins. I love 98 so much.
We've talked about this on the pod before, but you and I were in sports media at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting in the office with the producers and we had a big discussion. Okay, so if we're not carrying baseball, what do we do? And we discussed the cut-in strategy because every at-bat was moving towards history. And it wasn't even just the final days.
No.
Like it was
home run 55.
Yeah, it was a lead up. Yeah. Like it was, there was serious storytelling that was happening in real time across multimedia. And, you know, before the internet really had the ability to make everything simultaneous and ubiquitous, mm-hmm. you really had to strategize around this stuff. And it was fun.
You had to work for it. You had to, and that's another thing. You had to work for it. My favorite movie going experience isn't my favorite movie of all time. My favorite movie going experience was seeing Michael Keaton's Batman. We lined up for 3-4 hours just for the opportunity to buy a ticket at noon. Then we got our tickets for like a 7 o'clock show. Then we lined up several hours before so we'd have a decent seat. And when that theater was packed, when it went dark, everyone clapped. When Jack Nicholson's name appeared on the screen, Nicholas's name, Nicholson, goddamn, I'm always going to screw that up. Damn you, both Jacks. The whole audience cheered.
All right, I realize I'm delving into toxic masculinity here, but I saw a picture of Debbie Harry the other day, and she was a Playboy bunny when she first started out.
Yeah.
So there was a picture of her as a Playboy bunny on one of the punk feeds that I follow.
Yeah.
And it got me to thinking about when I was in grade 6 and I went to a sleepover at Derek Knight's house, and mm-hmm. his dad had a stack of Playboys, and yep. so we waited for him to go to bed, and then we snuck them out. How crazy is this? Do you know where we slept? We actually slept on the balcony of his apartment. There was like 6 kids out there. Could you imagine like a dad just saying, ah, fuck it, kids. Knock yourselves out. Go sleep on the balcony.
No. No. I bet that was a great sleepover.
It was like one of the greatest. But it got me to thinking about how much we valued the rare opportunity to do some form of exploration.
Yes.
As opposed to now where it's, I think kids are like burnt out by 14. Like they've had it around them their whole lives.
Their pleasure centers are getting completely fried.
Just fried. Just like.
By the way, we would have done the same thing. If you'd given us the technology now when we were that age, you know what, just get it on. It would be fried as well.
Matt, I have to argue with my daughter mm-hmm. every day yeah. about how much internet she should be using, especially like phone time.
What is her, like, let's treat this like a Rasmus Sandin contract negotiation. How much does she want versus how much do you want?
Okay, so she wants, like Mitch Marner, she wanted the Austin Matthews money.
Yeah.
Unlike Mitch Marner, she hasn't earned it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Mitch didn't either. I guess that's a whole other debate for the last 4 years. But we've kind of settled on if you have no homework, you can have 2 hours of screen time.
Right.
If you have homework, you can have whatever's left over.
Right.
Up to 2 hours.
Yep.
That sounds like a lot to me. Mm-hmm. But during the pandemic, it was 14 to 16 hours a day of being on screens.
Yeah. And there's nothing you can do, or like you can try your best. But.
Well, especially because she's an only kid. And yeah. so there wasn't even another kid. Like it was kind of unfair to say, hey, can't you entertain yourself?
Yeah.
Well, you can do that for half an hour. Like we're all like, oh man, when I was a kid, I could entertain myself. Yeah, sure. But you also got to go outside and see other children.
Yeah.
Like try and do that every day for 10 hours.
I remember when my school went on strike in grade 6, me and 5 friends, every day it was just dirt bikes. Just dirt bikes.
There's a reason why Stranger Things resonates with kids who didn't even grow up that way. Mm-hmm. It's because they look at that and they're like, fuck, you mean we can just jump on our bikes and go anywhere?
Yeah.
And hang out with our friends?
That's right.
And your parents don't have a microchip in your phone? And
they're too busy living their own lives and drinking. They don't care about us.
Honestly, like one of the things that ruined parenting is when we were expected to be sober.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys get a raw deal. You guys have to be a lot more responsible.
So I had a conversation with Rick Chisholm, who was the VP of production at TSN when I first started producing there. We were out on the road and we were having a beer and he laughed and he said, you kids don't party the way we did.
Yep.
But he took a different tack on it and he said, and it's our fault because we ask you to do so much more than we were asked to do when we were your age. If you tried to do things that we did with what we ask you to do, you'd be fired.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't do it right. It wouldn't be possible. That's kind of like the parenting thing right now is I don't think parents ever wanted to be bad parents. But like everything else, it's a 24/7 thing now. When I look at pictures of these families back in the 60s and like mom and dad are having smokes and everybody's over and the kids yep. are like running around. It's like that looks pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, kids are running around, do what they want. Someone's got a martini. By the way, I like we got lucky. We got lucky to at least be teenagers without the internet And we got lucky that we weren't teenagers, say, in 1941. You know, or now our
going to war.
Now our responsibilities are bombing Germans. You know, like being 18 at the time where Phil Hartman was big on TV, not a bad time.
The best time to be a teen was the 70s because all anybody wanted to do was have fun
yep.
and sex.
Yep.
And the movies were great. The cars were big.
So to quote Kroll again, it was pre-AIDS, but cocaine.
Yeah.
Cocaine was big, and there was no such thing as AIDS.
The 60s and the 70s were the fuck around time.
Yeah.
And the 80s onwards were the find out time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although there was a brief moment in the 90s, and it didn't really happen in Canada, but around club culture in the UK, I think they had a lot of fun.
Okay.
It looked like it was pretty good.
Yeah.
You're not a club guy, though.
No. I'm fine with that. Like, yeah.
You're a sports bar guy.
Sports bar or wine bar?
Yeah, now you're a wine bar. But that's what happens when sports bar kids grow up and get money. Yeah. They become wine bar guys, which are basically sports bars for people in their 40s.
Yeah. By the way, I'm still going to the sports bar, but I'm sports bar, wine bar. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you can't do sports bar anymore because you don't want to stand. You don't want to be standing around the table.
No. I want the wings and the Coors Light, but I'd also like a chair. I don't think that's asking I don't think that's asking too much.
I've only got a couple minutes. Have you watched Andor yet?
I haven't. Okay. I haven't yet, but it's at the top of my list. I finished Succession, so now and I watched Thor: Love and Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Not that good.
It's not that good.
It's not that good.
Okay, can I give you my take on Thor: Love and Thunder?
Yeah.
It's not just that they repeat most of the same beats from Ragnarok or the same kind of delivery.
Yeah.
But it's a villain problem.
Yeah.
You know, they just Marvel trots out these miscellaneous, like, you know.
He's not earned. Christian Bale's a great character, but his villainy isn't earned.
Yeah, there's just nothing interesting about that. You know, they quickly tried to sandwich in some backstory so I would have, you know. Like, it really goes to show what a great job both Marvel and Josh Brolin did with Thanos.
Yes.
Thanos was a fully realized villain, and he was a thrill to watch.
You know what's even remarkable about that? He's a fully realized villain who's CGI. Usually the fully realized villains are humans with subtlety and the proper emotional notes and ticks on the face, you know, like an Anthony Hopkins from Signs of the Lambs. This was a fully realized CGI villain.
So Marvel, this new wave, was cemented back in the day by the X-Men, which was the result of two things. Hugh Jackman's performance as Wolverine was really magnetic and people loved it. And Magneto.
Mm-hmm.
Magneto was a great villain. So as great as Patrick Stewart was as Professor X, he was playing tennis with Ian McKellen, who's pretty fucking good too, right? Then Thanos really set up the Avengers arc.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was a great villain at the heart of it, the actions of the heroes meant so much more. You really had, like, you wanted Ultron to be that in the second one. And James Spader was actually really good. I feel like it was almost there.
Stumbled right at the finish line. It was almost there.
So here's my hot take.
Okay.
This next phase is going to depend on how good Doctor Doom is.
Yes. Yeah.
Kang might be great.
Yeah.
We'll have to see. But I kind of feel like they need even more.
Man, every Fantastic Four movie has been such a piece of shit.
Doom is.
Doctor Doom's a great villain. It's a great villain. Great villain. I love Fantastic Four. Grew up on Fantastic Four.
I would argue Doom is the second greatest comic book villain after Joker. Magneto's up there.
Magneto.
Luthor's up there.
Green Goblin.
Maybe if you love Spider-Man, but I think the other thing is you have to have a lot of power to be a great villain. You have to be able to destroy the world.
Well, but see, that's a debate because, like, sometimes, like, this is my problem with the Captain Marvel movies. It was like, okay, so her power is every power, and then the villain must have every power. Like, it just.
Yeah.
Joker couldn't destroy the world, but Joker could do things so that the world could destroy itself.
Galactus? Ooh. No, that's pretty good. Ooh. That's pretty good. I think there are smaller villains that are really awesome that we learn to love within our sort of little mini universes. But in terms of the big picture, you got to be able to win.
Yeah.
And beat all the heroes. And Doom is so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that he's kind of like the shadow figure to Mr. Fantastic.
Adds to it as well.
It's so good. Like, there's so much riding on the Fantastic Four.
There really is. Jesus, if they can nail that.
It's also, like, if it sucks, at some point, like, the thing about Marvel, and I'm sure you still feel this way, but less, they were on a run there where you were like, I will see anything they do because I love it all.
Yeah.
There's about 8, 9, 10 films in a row. Mm-hmm. Like, even the Ant-Man stuff, you're like, even I didn't love it. But you know what? That was fun. Hey, Paul Rudd's fun. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Like, I'm enjoying it. Guardians of the Galaxy. I didn't think it'd be that good, but it was.
It was. You know what this is right now?
Hmm.
That Marvel run is when the NFL teams got the franchise quarterback. And then the recent stuff on TV is when they're now trying to replace it with the next guy. So, you know, if I'll do the Bills, because you can't do the Packers because they just went from Brett Favre to Aaron Rodgers. Totally not fair. But the Bills, Jim Kelly for so long. And then, woof, did you have a parade of shit. And now you got Josh Allen.
And, you know, we lived with Michael Jordan, and then we went through 10 years of who's the next Michael Jordan, and then LeBron comes, and eventually there is another Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
In tennis right now, the big three are kind of on the, you know, back end
Federer's
of the back
done.
Nine.
Nadal's got a little time left, and Djokovic has, he's got to wait for vaccine mandates to lower.
Yeah.
Him and Kyrie can hang out.
But now you're trying to convince yourself that Carlos Alcaraz is really exciting.
Yeah.
You know, he's just not there yet. It's exciting. It's fun. But he hasn't earned it yet.
A slow Wednesday in July. I'll talk about him.
And then there was like a couple films in a row with Marvel where it's like, oh, I wanted to love this, but I don't. Like, this is your point about Love and Thunder. There's no way you didn't sit down hoping to love it.
Of course. Same guy who did Jojo Rabbit. I'm going to follow.
You love Taika.
Yep. Yes.
You know, it's your kind of comedy.
Yep.
All of it. But, you know, the one for me that really disappointed me, we'll leave the TV out of it, but it was the Doctor Strange movie.
Mm.
Just felt so slapped together.
Yes. Well, because they changed directors, and then it literally became like slap director.
And then they were supposed to release it before they released WandaVision, but then because of COVID, it had to get moved around. So you had these like shitty scenes that were thrown together to put continuity in there. I watched that, and I was so ready for that to be like, you know, amazing. Like, Marvel wants to do horror, and this is going to be freaky and like 70s weird.
Yep.
It was kind of just like, last thought on this one. Benedict Cumberbatch.
Mm-hmm.
Is he any good?
Yeah, he's got bona fides in the past. Okay. You know, the Imitation Games. He was really good in that. So he does have some stuff to. And I never saw the Sherlock Holmes stuff he did.
Really good.
Okay. Yeah.
I wonder if it's just the American accent that I'm not buying.
Mm. You need, it gets me. Like, I get fooled by it.
Okay. Last thought.
Yeah.
What actor are you shocked when you hear them speak normally?
Ooh, Hugh Laurie.
Oh,
from Blackadder and stuff. And I know he did like House or whatever the show was. And, you know, that he's very, very American. Scalpel now. And then like, hello. You know, like, yeah, I'm going to go with him.
Yeah, I'm going to say either Gary Oldman or Christian Bale for me.
Mm.
It's like, wait a minute.
Yes,
Gary Oldman's
a good one.
That's not you.
Yes.
Get out of here.
Yes, Gary Oldman is a good one.
Yeah. I think it would have been fun to be Gary Oldman.
Ooh. I'm now trying to think of like what is the best Gary Oldman era.
He's kind of like the non-sleazy art Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
Like
he's
just always been cool.
Yes.
And you have a feeling he's had a lot of fun.
That is a great analogy. I don't think we're going to do better.
Yeah.
Goodbye, Bob.
Bye, Matt.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.